previously on Popping Collars.
But I think that people still sometimes see institutions as following those old rules. And like that, like it hasn't changed yet. Like the journalism hasn't changed. Like there still must be an office somewhere where you guys get together and like somebody's like, I've got a great story, and you're like, no, we're gonna scrap it and we're gonna run with this one. You know, it's like All the President's Men, Episcopal Cafe edition, you know, that kind of thing. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture, the show where priests, pastors, ministers, and religious thinkers from around the country weigh in on what people are binge-watching, tweeting about, trolling on message boards, and celebrating on blogs. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida, and I am your host of this roundtable conversation with our guests. What am I talking about? Our co-hosts, Betsy Gonzalez from Alexandria, Virginia. Hey, Betsy.
Hey.
And Liz Easton from Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Liz.
Hey, guys.
This is episode 24 of Popping Collars, and our topic today is Inside Out, the latest Pixar film, unless you're listening to this after The Good Dinosaur was released. I saw a great quote on Twitter that said this movie shouldn't have been called Inside Out. It should have been called Me Ugly Crying in a Movie Theater for 2 hours. It's a really gripping story of a young girl named Riley and the emotions that guide her actions, said emotions being portrayed as anthropomorphic creatures living inside of Riley's brain, where a world is constantly being created around them. And so I'm wondering, was there an image or a piece of Riley's mind that either of you found particularly compelling?
Okay, first off, all Pixar movies are called ugly crying, snotty, who got extra napkins in the dark in the theater. Let's just be honest, right? Right, they're all that. You know, I watched this movie next to my kid, you know, who's gone through what Riley has gone through recently and moved in the last year and the new friends and having emotionally as a parent done the work of going through the night, every night. I hate it. I hate it. I want to leave. I want my friends. I hate it. I hate crying. Like, I was like, oh no, this is going to trigger something for her. She's going to have like PTSD into our movie experience. And she's going to be like, that's right, Riley. We're running away and I'm out of here. I was a little worried. But I mean, I have to say the thing that I really liked is the idea that of the islands in Riley's brain. And that kind of the island's connection to the core memories. And that all the time, I think, as parents or anybody who has a kid in your life in whatever fashion, you say, you anchor yourself at times to, my kid is like this. My kid likes this. She will eat this. Is friends with this person. Has this kind of personality. This is who my kid really is. And then we get all frustrated when they go off and change and they grow and they have new experiences. And what do you mean you won't eat that anymore? And I thought we liked Susie. Why don't we like Susie anymore? And we start to feel at sea, right? But that the growing part is natural. And that after the destruction, because when those islands are falling, it was like, good God. You know, I know what that feels like, right? And to then be able to be like, oh no, look at what was built afterwards. It's core her, it's real, it's allowing ourselves as adults, kids in particular, to grow and change. I think I liked that as a physical manifestation in her brain. I understood that.
I also was drawn to the islands, and I don't have kids. So, like, what Betsy's describing is totally fascinating and really beautiful to me, and also kind of unknown and mysterious. So when I was first introduced to the islands, I was like, yeah, that's about right. Like, those make sense. Those are kind of the pillars of her personality. And then when they broke apart and were rebuilt, I don't know how to say it. I understood sort of the elegance of that and how true that is. And really, we're all doing that. We're all transforming all the time and, you know, are changing those islands. The landscape of those islands changes. So that was moving to me. And also the core memories. I'm really interested in trying to recall my first memories. You know, and they're hard to pin down, right? Like, but what are those? And I think that when you really explore those and kind of pick them up and look around, you learn a lot about yourself. You know, why do I react in certain ways to certain things? Why do some things make me sad or make me scared? And a lot of those, I think, are really well grounded in the things that you remember from 3 years old. They're not the only things that happened at 3 years old, but for whatever reason, they're the things that your ego just latched onto and built around.
I think what stood out to me as someone who has issues with control and wanting to be in control a lot, I was really, I don't know, surprised by the control boards. So when the movie starts, it's just a button, right? It's just Joy pushing a button. I mean, it's really lovely. Like, it's, you know, her just kind of pushing this thing. And then once we kind of get to know, get into the story and get to know Riley better, we see that, oh, it's not just Joy, it's these other characters. Oh, and they're sitting at kind of this console. And then you go into the minds of the parents and you realize that, like, they have these super consoles of, like, you know, all these, you know, this crazy equipment. And their emotions know the board very well. Like, I mean, they never really referenced the boards. It was something that you kind of had to pay attention to and realize, like, oh, wait, that's different. Oh, yeah, wait, it was a button when this thing first started. And I think that that's something that occurs to me about, you know, when you were talking about your memories, Liz. That's something that I think about. Sometimes these things, especially when it comes to, like, the things that you can control, they happen so gradually that you don't even really notice that they're changing. And they're right there in the center, and they're changing constantly. But your life kind of makes sense to you at the pace that it's going, and it doesn't really seem like this big of a deal that things are growing and things are changing. You're learning how to operate the system better. The thing about Riley is that we're experiencing the movie sort of through her emotions and stuff, and Joy is kind of the leader of her emotions, right? She's kind of like the central. She's the first emotion. She's the one that we're kind of following throughout the narrative. But then you kind of get glimpses into the parents' heads and you realize that, like, her mom, it's sadness is running the board, right? And for her dad, it's anger is running the board. And you get the sense that, I mean, you don't get the sense that the dad is an angry person. And you don't get the sense that the mom is a very sad person. But, you know, it tells you that, you know, for some people, there may be something that sits at the core of them that isn't outward, but it's very much a part of how they kind of experience the world.
I have friends who saw this movie with their teenage and preteen daughters, and that was kind of the big conversation that they took home with them and talked about for a couple of days was which feeling, which emotion would be running your board. And they were surprised by what their kids said to them. You know, that it was sadness or it was fear. It's like, wow, you know, I wouldn't have known that about you.
Yeah, I didn't fully recognize that the other emotions were running the board. I was so wrapped up in the kid that I just I didn't even see that. Wow, that's really cool. There are times when other emotions are really taking the forefront, taking the lead. And I think that's why it's frustrating to have an 8-year-old who's starting to make those noises like, oh, do we have to go do that? I'm like, what? Where's the kid who would try anything new? Who would, you know, just step into a new experience and be excited about it? Now there is so much guffawing and, you know, the eye rolling has started and you just kind of, it's other people playing at the board where they used to be like, that's great, Mom. I'll wear whatever you pick and let's go try something new today. You know, no. We're not there anymore. And then you're kind of like, what did I do? And no, it's them. It's them changing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. I think, you know, you were talking about the islands before, and one of the big islands was Goofball Island.
Goofball.
Right? This idea. Yeah. This where you can just be silly, and that's the place to be silly, and it's okay to be silly. as a concept, that's totally cool. Like, I get that. Like, I encourage my daughter, like, yeah, you can be a goofball. Just don't be a goofball, like, now, you know, and you start to find your times when you're, like, stifling that as a parent, where you're like, could you just, like, no, stop it. Just, you know, just don't act like a cat right now. Like, do something, you know, I'm trying to tell you to do something. For me, I was like, I was watching that, I was like, oh, okay, so how is that affecting how she understands this goofball world? Me telling her, no. What are you doing to affect how they experience that?
You know, if I hadn't lost the same islands that Riley did, Goofball Island would be the one that I missed the most. Hmm. Like, I think as adults, and it's not even as very young adults and teenagers and preteens, that it's judgment and fear of judgment that kills Goofball Island. You know, and the more that we become aware of, you kind of need to stack up in a certain way and people are watching you and expecting you, you know, certain things of you. And some people never leave Goofball Island. And I admire that more and more as I get older. When I meet those adults who are just having a great time and like totally, that's vulnerability. Goofball Island is a super vulnerable place because you're just putting yourself out there. And
that's what I actually find is so helpful, to not get wrapped up in my own stuff, or to, when you talk with others about their emotions, othering them in a way, having them be separate things, allows you to kind of parse out and actually make better sense of what's going on inside your head. I mean, because I think about Christianity and, you know, a message of faith and in any general way is trying to be that joy mixed with the sadness. The joy mixed with the tears, right? And that's life experience. You know, the fact that it was the two of them who went on that journey together, you know, that we left anger, fear, disgust helming the board to their detriment, but that the people who really needed to work it out were joy and sadness. Mm-hmm. And those moments of great sadness where we rush so quickly to joy. You know, that yearning to really have, you know, when someone dies, to really have a wake, which feels so old, ancient and Irish and Catholic or whatever, you know, but we yearn for that moment of sharing those stories of that person and being so sad that they're gone before we move to the resurrection of burial, before mm-hmm. we're saying alleluia at the grave. You know, there's this. We've moved away from that first part. And so we're just kind of find ourselves, all right, here we go. Right. You know, they've gone to a better place. God need another angel and all of that other BS. You know, but we're sad. It's about the people here.
Right. That's why it always irks me. And I found this as a parish priest sometimes, but I hear it way more in popular culture, like in people who don't necessarily attend to a religious faith, of like, when I die, I want my funeral to be purely joyful. I don't want any tears. Make it a celebration of my life. Make it, you know. And what we learn in the faith tradition is yes, and it's both of those things. But honestly, when I die, I want you all to be crying. It's sad. Mm-hmm. It's really sad. Like,
super sad.
How dare we tell people that it isn't? You know, yeah. What a horrible thing. And then joy is right on its heels. It's the same thing. It's two different sides of the same coin. And other feelings are like that too. Like, I think for a lot of people, fear and anger are like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's that element that reminds me of kind of the New Orleans funeral mm-hmm. march, right? You know, that it goes from a dirge, slow, mournful, you can transition mm-hmm. to the second line and the joy, but you need to have the first part first.
Right. It doesn't just start out that way. Yeah.
Right.
So my job is working with kids, right? Children and youth ministries and stuff. You know, part of this kind of speaks to a lot of my world, you know, which is we try to find as many, I think, positive stories for kids, especially in scripture, as possible. And you start to realize that there really aren't that many. And that's why you kind of rush to Christmas as quickly as possible, because that's like the one that's like really good, right? Like a baby gets born. So that's awesome. And then they ask, like, oh, well, what happens to that baby? It's like, he dies.
But you're out of school on Good Friday, so you might not even be aware.
That happens all the time. It's like, you know, you do like Moses parting the Red Sea. It's like, oh, cool. So he makes it to the Promised Land? No, he dies. You know, and you're constantly kind of doing this push-pull where you're like, yeah, you know, this really great thing happens. And then, you know, this really sucky thing happens too. And I think that the piece where I find really the best learning happens is when we're okay discussing the sucky piece, knowing that the good stuff is still there, but knowing that the suck part is there too, and not being ashamed to kind of admit it. And yeah, that's where I see that kind of parallel with the funeral piece a lot, is that it's okay to tell people that are in mourning, like, this sucks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's been a lot of developmental talk around resiliency. If you're fighting with, you know, your spouse, partner, whatever, and you say, well, Dad and I are going to go talk about this upstairs. The kids never see the resolution of the fight. They never see what happened. So all they're left with is the fight. And the families that gloss over the family stories of, you know, the grandpa who drinks too much, and that's why we don't see him, or times when we didn't have a lot of money, or ups and downs in your, you know, if you share your family story with each other, with children, your spiritual family story, and are real about it, and it's up and it's down, then when we hit the down, we're less likely to be like, oh my gosh, it's over. It's over. Sorry, cashing out. It's all over. You know, we're more likely to be like, oh, we've done this before, or I know people who've done this before who I can go talk to, that we know there's another way. We know there's a way to bounce back. We know there's a way to go. And when we hide too much, and when we don't talk about what's real, and we don't talk about things that suck, we rob each other of being able to be like, oh, well, you know, they were in the crap on this, and I am now, and I know who to talk to.
That's literally my job, is getting churches to tell those stories. And it is really hard. It is. I think it's even harder than doing that in your own family of origin or your own personal family.
One of the things that can make it hard sometimes is that people will remember things differently. And that's something that I appreciate about this movie, is the way that memories work, right? Because there are a ton of memories. This is just like an 8-year-old girl, and she's got walls and walls and walls of memories, right? And you think to yourself, like, you know, what must that be like for, you know, someone who's 50, 60, 70, right? Like, how many memories must they have to pull from? But then, like, how do they remember those things? That's where we keep getting back into this frustrating, you know, cycle of, well, you know, it used to be really great. Well, was it? You know, like, I'm sure there were some frustrations even then, right? And I'm sure that the folks that were older then probably remembered it differently. And I think that's the thing that sort of resonated with me once joy and sadness kind of get lost in Riley's mind a little bit, is just the chasms that in the you know, the hallways that we can create for ourselves, thinking, you know, oh man, that was great, that was really great, when in reality, like, we're just stacking up memory after memory, and we're probably conflating things that had nothing to do with each other. And I thought the movie did that really well. I'm gonna steal your thing, Liz. In the narrative of the movie, Bing Bong, the imaginary friend, sacrifices himself so the joy isn't forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man,
Christ figure.
That's a sermon, right?
Christ figure.
You know, sacrificing yourself so the joy isn't forgotten. Yeah, I'm sure at some point he had himself in the cruciform while he was on the back of the wheelbarrow with the arms out. You know.
Well, and when you
is finished, joy.
Well, when you think about the Psalms and the way they talk about the pit and the miry pit and being forgotten, and can you ever be so far from God that God doesn't see you and God doesn't know you? I mean, I think envisioning that kind of pit of forgottenness is an interesting way to think about that, and how much we work so hard to not be forgotten and to actually be forgotten. That's frightening.
I was just, I cried the most at that part, actually. I mean, I cried, like everyone else, I cried, like, at Pixar movies, like a baby. But when he was disappearing, I was, like, almost choking, crying. And I think that was it. It was so final. Like, this vestige of her childhood and, like, a really pure part of her childhood is just gone and gone forever. She will never remember him.
I remember wanting to have an imaginary friend.
You just couldn't make it happen.
I couldn't make it happen. I was trying to be cool. Oh, kids would stare.
Did you pretend to have an imaginary friend?
Was your
imaginary friend lived in Canada?
Yes.
And was really pretty.
With my boyfriend, my summer camp boyfriend from Canada. They were off together. Yeah. I think I faked it. I think I faked an imaginary friend.
The other piece that I appreciated, I think, towards the end was when Joy realizes that this core memory that she has of, or this memory that she has of Riley being carried by her teammates after a hockey game also includes a sad piece to it, right? Where they've lost the game that they were playing. And this idea that these memories aren't just one thing or another. They're like, they're integrated and they flow. And, you know, the thing that's beautiful about the end of the movie is that you start to see more colors appear in Riley's memories. And they're colors that sometimes will swirl so that it's like a blue and a tan, you know, or a blue and a red memory kind of existing together. But especially the sadness and joy moments felt to me like what grief kind of feels like, because you have this memory of something lovely and special that you hold dear, and yet there's a sad piece to it. You know, either it's something that you've lost or something that's been changed irrevocably and you can't, like, you'll never be able to go back to when it was purely joyful. All throughout the movie, Joy is just trying to, like, suppress that idea of, like, no, like, this memory can't have any sadness in it. This memory can't have sadness. Otherwise, it's, like, tainted somehow. But real grief, I think, is admitting that that sadness is there and claiming the duality of that memory. Like, the fact that you can be happy and sort of sad about something at the same time.
Well, and if we're going all Kubler-Ross on it, it has more than just those feelings, right? There's also anger, and there's also, you know, disgust, and all of them are wrapped up in grief.
Yeah, we're almost trying to joyify everything, or whatever. You know, like when people's anniversaries happen on Facebook, and it's like, to my partner for life, and you're the best, and yeah! You know, like, we're really trying to be like, but you know, sometimes being married to you is a job. It is hard. You know, and people never, you know, we don't say those things. We don't say those things, you know, things have been written, you know, talking real about marriage or things like that is one of the harder parts. People do not do on Facebook. You'll talk about your kid having trouble teething or sleeping or whatever, but talking about our relationships, you know, we joyify them all the time. And it's like denying the swirl, denying the mix. And actually being okay with the mix. You know, we've all watched family members like intensely try to throw the best Christmas ever, you know, and that it's, but the ones you remember and the ones that you talk about, the ones where the tree fell over and it's like Christmas vacation and it's a mess and, you know, and that there's more to it. There's more color in it than we're actually allowing to happen. And we want to deny the swirl. That can be a thing.
Well, I had a conversation this morning with some colleagues similarly about this, but it was about ministry. And we were talking about how easy it is to look at our colleagues and be like, gosh, they really have this all figured out. They have this all together. And they're thinking the same thing. And we're very rarely actually talking about it. Like, we're all just freaking out here. Like, we're all just trying to do the best we can and we're all struggling. And I think the same is true for marriage, Betsy, like you mentioned, and probably for parenting, I would say, that as a person who isn't married, I often look at my married friends and think like, God, you guys, you have everything. Like, you have it all together. Like, your life, you know, whatever. And yeah, because nobody is telling the truth. Like, God, this sucks sometimes. You're like, I struggle with the same things you do. I have trouble with my priorities. I have trouble making decisions and, you know, that benefit everything, whatever. We're all kind of in the same boat, but the pieces are different. But we don't talk about it.
Yeah, well, to admit that would be to come to a place of true vulnerability. And, you know, I think our churches are a lot of things. Vulnerable isn't one of the first words that comes to mind. And I think of, even just the structure of our liturgy. Sometimes it's the striving for perfection, or at least the striving for, like, you know, everything's got to be in its place. It's this idea of order, right? Mm-hmm. But what are the, I mean, you're totally right, Betsy. Like, I think that idea of the, you know, the chaotic Christmas can totally apply to the chaotic liturgy. Like, the ones that you remember are the ones where, you know, somebody forgot to put the reading in the lectern, you know?
Someone, like, passes out. Right, something, well, is, cool. The wine spills all over the altar. I still have memories of those kinds of liturgies from, you know.
And I think that that's, like, sure. there's got to be something true about that, right? Like, I feel like the feeding of the 5,000 had to have been, like, this horrible mistake that somehow Jesus made holy, right? It's like, we can't feed these people, but somehow we'll feed these people. And I just think that there's a lesson there for us somewhere. Maybe not to hold on too tight. You know, you hold on loosely and don't let go. Because if you cling too tightly, you're going to lose control.
Thank God. Foreigner? No, who is that?
I didn't even get it.
Is that Foreigner? Who was that?
I don't know. I think it's 38
Special. 38 Special. There we go. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Don't deny the swirl. Let's put that on a t-shirt.
Get out of my head a bit, out of the negative, out of the pessimist posture of doubt where everything's relative and everyone is my nemesis. Yeah, I just gotta get out of my bed again, get back in the game. Though I might never win, a fight might never end, and nothing is forever. Every day is heaven sent, and everything is better when I'm out of my head. The second I'm stepping out, whenever I look at you, the second I left the house, the scent of the fresh air, the wind that carries us, the feeling will get there. That's when we deal with what's real. Can't numb the pain to heal. One must feel the hurt for a season, but it hurts for a reason. Done dreaming out, I'm searching for meaning out of my head.
Do our going pieces segment. Liz, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
I live in Omaha, Nebraska. I'm the canon of the ordinary for the Diocese of Nebraska. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Liz East. That's it. I'm taking a lot of pictures of Nebraska. That's kind of what I do.
Betsy, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
So I serve as chaplain in the great state of Virginia. At Episcopal High School, and you can find me on Twitter at Betsy_Gons.
My name is Greg Knight. I am the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida. You can find us on the web at bbts.org. You can find me on Twitter at ThatGregKnight. Popping Collars, you can find on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on the Facebook where you can like or friend us. You can find us on Instagram. Popping Collars Podcast, or you can email us should you still live in the 20th century, poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com. We are the 1,344th ranked spirituality podcast on iTunes, just ahead of Billings Living Faith and right behind Westerville Christian Church. So go ahead and feel free to subscribe so we can show those Westerville people who's boss.
Finally, our show is featured each and every time on Episcopal Cafe. .com. We love Episcopal Cafe. We recommend them to you for all of your Episcopal news and beyond. With that, this has been Popping College for this time. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Betsy, for being on. We'll see you next time.
Keep those collars popped. Wait.